Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Current issue of The Atlantic has a fascinating story about Timothy Geithner. It is titled Inside Man, and Joshua Green is the author of the piece. Joshua is senior editor of The Atlantic. He's covered politics since joining the magazine in 2003. He's written for The New Yorker, Esquire, Rolling Stone, and other publications. Previously editor at The Washington Monthly, he began his career as an editor at the satirical weekly The Onion, back at a time, as Chrissy Pease, our producer, says, when that failed to impress anyone. Different story now. Recently, he was named one of Columbia Journalism Review's 10 Young Writers on the Rise, and his writing has been anthologized in books ranging from the Best American Political Writing 2009 to the Bob Marley Reader. We'll be welcoming phone calls about Timothy Geithner. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Joshua. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
All right. Timothy Geithner, you say, well, you say a lot in the article. His career coincides almost exactly with an important shift in how the Democratic Party thinks about finance. Can you talk about that? He sort of is a guy who's been here at the right time, I guess. How does it coincide?
Well, in a historical sense, it coincides with the idea that, you know, if you go back to the New Deal era and Franklin Roosevelt, the Democratic Party fundamentally was kind of opposed to Wall Street, to bankers, to moneyed interests, what Roosevelt called the malefactors of great wealth. And that was true for many, many years, but it began to change in the mid-1970s. It changed quite dramatically in the 80s and 90s when Democrats became much more sympathetic, not just to Wall Street, but to the idea that markets should be unfettered, unencumbered by regulation, and led Democrats to be complicit with Republicans in stripping away a lot of the protections, the financial regulations that had been instituted in the New Deal, and the removal of which allowed for the recent financial crisis to occur. That really picked up speed in the late 80s, and especially during the Clinton years of the 90s, and that is the time at which Geithner arrived in Washington in the Treasury Department and really kind of rose to power.
Mm-hmm. So many people, ever since he was just starting out, really thought of him as a superstar. I can't remember who said that about him. Maybe a lot of people have said this, but he's a very smart guy, isn't he?
Well, yeah, very smart guy. What's interesting about Geithner is that for as prominent and important he is, a guy as he is, he's generally thought of as almost these kind of two polar opposite cartoon figures. If you're a Republican, you tend to think that he's, this socialist agent of the Obama agenda who's trying to, put capitalism under government control. If you're a liberal, you tend to see him as this, craven tool of Wall Street, who is spending taxpayer money to bail out, moneyed Wall Street bankers. The truth is that Geithner is neither, and that what he really is and has been all his career is a superstar of the bureaucracy in Washington and also in the Federal Reserve in New York. And the ambition of this piece is to kind of pull back the curtain a little bit and explain who this guy really is, who's so important yes. To our country over these last couple of years, but who, despite that importance, remains largely unknown and I would argue misunderstood.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about his early life. He's really a child of the world in many ways, traveling all over with his dad because of the nature of his dad's work.
Yeah, his dad worked for the Ford Foundation and grew up had worked for some NGOs before that and grew up all over the world, often in poor countries. He lived in India, Thailand, Africa. His sister was born in Zimbabwe. So he had a very interesting kind of international upbringing, similar to Barack Obama's in many senses. And moved back to the States. He went to Dartmouth College and then got a degree in international relations from Johns Hopkins and was sort of following his father's path into government work on the international relations side. He worked originally for Henry Kissinger's consulting firm right after he got out of graduate school, and then moved into the Treasury Department as like a 25, 26-year-old aide at the end of the second George W. Bush administration, and really just rose like a meteor from then on through the bureaucratic ranks of the Treasury all the way up to the top.
Did his living in various places and the background he had give him a keener sense of what was going on when markets started having troubles all around the world?
I think he did. I think his upbringing had two effects. Number one, his parents and all of their friends worked for organizations like Oxfam and CARE and World Bank and Amnesty International. These are agencies that basically exist to fill in the gap. When government fails, when they can't get things done, these organizations kind of come in and try and redirect policy, help people out. They do so in a way that's not forceful. It tends to be kind of more tangential. They you know, build consensus. They try and steer and cajole. That very much informs the way that Geithner does his job. I think the other thing important about his upbringing and his time overseas is that he happened to live in places like Japan, for instance, in the late 1980s, when the Japanese economy experienced a collapse and a banking crisis that was devastating and lasted 10 years. So Geithner kind of came of age professionally during a series of really serious financial crises all across the globe that helped inform how he thinks and how he reacted to our financial crisis.
Mm-hmm. And I know he spent time in Japan. Can you tell me what he learned from, and I guess they're still dealing with what happened with their banking crisis. What did he learn from what the Japanese government was doing in terms of what needed to happen in the United States, if anything?
Well, he went to Tokyo as a very young assistant treasury attaché in the U.S. Embassy in 1990, and he arrived just after the Japanese real estate bubble burst, and the Nikkei index began its dizzying fall. This is the very beginning of what people now call Japan's lost decade of deflation and stagnation. And the problem at the heart of that was that the Japanese government was loath to kind of recognize their banking problem. They didn't act, and they sort of took this laissez-faire, hands-off policy where they hoped that banks could kind of outgrow the crisis, absorb the losses, and that didn't happen. It was just devastating for the economy in Japan. And what Geithner learned from that experience was that the worst thing you can do in a banking crisis is to do nothing, and that if you move quickly, you know, if you recapitalize banks, the quicker you do that, the quicker your economy can recover from the crisis. And if you look at the way Geithner and his colleagues reacted to the financial crisis here, you can see them almost every point kind of moving to do the opposite of what the Japanese government did 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the image of him, and I'm wondering if I know that you're shedding light on who he really is in this article, but it's interesting that I think this image of him is one that many have coalesced in the early weeks of the Obama administration. You write, awkward, halting, out of his depth, mocked on Saturday Night Live, is precisely the opposite of the view held by those who have known him. Would it serve us well to know him as the people who know him do?
I think it would help people to understand him. Whether that's for better or for worse is up for debate. But Geithner is a very, you know, the title of this piece is The Inside Man, and Geithner, throughout his career, has been a very, very savvy inside player. His skill set does not include public speaking. He's not Barack Obama on the stump.
No, he's not.
And when he came out and gave this speech, it was an utter disaster, and the market crashed, and as I say in the piece, you know, the idea emerged of Geithner as this kind of little lawn gnome who, you know, what was this guy doing, and was he up to the job of kind of containing this financial crisis? It was interesting to me because when you go back and talk to people in Republican administrations and Democratic administrations, that is just the precise opposite of the view that they have of Geithner. Is this very savvy, shrewd strategist who always has a plan, who always knows how to operate.
Mm-hmm. How was he chosen to be Treasury Secretary? Talk about why it wasn't Sumner, why it was Geithner. What was he bringing to the administration?
Well, I think he brought a couple of things. If you go back to just after the election, the thinking was that, or at least Obama officials sort of let it be known that there were really kind of three people in the running. One was Larry Summers, who'd been Treasury Secretary at the end of the Clinton administration and an important advisor to the Obama campaign. One was Geithner, who didn't have a relationship with Obama at all, but had been instrumental in responding to the crisis from his role as president of the New York Fed. The other guy was Paul Volcker, who I think was never really in the running, but you know, a very respected figure. The idea of associating his name with Obama, I think, kind of reflected a little bit of gravitas onto Obama, who was, you know, a young and untested president. And the expectation among most people was that Summers would get the job, and Summers wanted the job. That changed when Geithner sat down for a 65-minute interview with Obama, and by all accounts, just dazzled him.
And he must have.
Must have, yeah. And if you look at, I mean, one of the interesting things about Geithner is if you look at kind of the pattern of his career, he has an uncanny talent for kind of maneuvering in to become the right-hand man of very powerful people. He did it with Henry Kissinger. He did it as Larry Summers' deputy at the Treasury Department. He did it with Bob Rubin, the Clinton Treasury Secretary, and my contention is this, in this piece, is that he's done the same thing with Barack Obama. We haven't really seen this or recognized this or acknowledged this on the outside, but in fact, I argue, he has become Obama's most important advisor. And whatever he said to Obama in that meeting, whether they bonded over their international background or Geithner's ideas about how to contain the crisis, he won the job right there and then. He wound up at Treasury and Summers wound up at the White House.
Mm-hmm. And they had to work together, Summers and Geithner, and have learned to respect each other?
They have always been friends, and they have certainly always respected each other. What's interesting is that, you know, Geithner's kind of rabbi in the Clinton administration Treasury was Larry Summers. Geithner was like a late 20s aide when Summers entered government in 1993, just after Clinton won. Was planning to just stick around for a couple weeks and get this new guy comfortable, and then Geithner was going to go off to a different job. And instead, he never left. He stayed as Larry Summers' deputy, and as Summers rose through the ranks, eventually becoming Treasury Secretary, Geithner rose along with him. He was protege. What's interesting about this administration is that the protege has sort of leapfrogged the mentor. They were both up for this Treasury job, and it was Geithner, not Summers, who got the job.
Mm-hmm. How close were we when he took over to a financial collapse in this country?
If you listen to people like Geithner and just about anybody else, we were very, very, very close. That especially after Lehman Brothers collapsed in September, we were kind of hanging on by a thread. You know, we sort of hit the depths of the crisis in March when the Dow got below 6,500. But from everything I've told, been told by, you know, people in the know and people I respect, not just Democrats but Republicans, Wall Street folks too, we were really close to that, and we're lucky that we haven't wound up in a second depression.
And he believed that you needed to act pretty quickly here, that you can't respond to this situation too slowly. Did he have a plan? Did he formulate a plan right away that was presented to the president that he thought probably nobody would think would be a great idea because it obviously wouldn't be popular among a whole lot of people considering who was being bailed out here. But was he with his plan right away?
Geithner told me that he came up with a plan while he was on a beach in Mexico on vacation in December. And if you think back then, you know, when Obama won the election and was taking over, the economy was in free fall. The GDP was shrinking at a rate of 6.4% in the fourth quarter of 2008. Nobody knew where the bottom was. Everybody was panicked. And Geithner drew on his experience battling financial crises in the Treasury to come up with his plan. And if you look at what he did, it's pretty clear where the ideas came from. What Geithner and what the Clinton Treasury did beginning in about 1995 was that they had to respond to a series of emerging market crises in Korea, in Thailand, in Brazil, in Russia. And what they basically did during those years was to kind of develop a playbook of how you deal with these things. You know, how do you stop the crisis from spreading? How do you get an economy back on its feet? How do you recapitalize banks, get them lending again, and sort of turn things around? It was pretty much that playbook that Geithner drew on to respond to the U.S. crisis. And what that entailed was frankly kind of pretty galling from a moral and ethical standpoint, because the lesson number one is that you have to come in and you have to recapitalize banks, despite the fact that, you know, they're the ones who caused all the problems. One of the reasons I think that Geithner is so unpopular, and one of the reasons that Obama has taken such a hit in a public approval standpoint, is that to do that is kind of appalling to voters who don't like the idea that their money is being used to bail out banks. Mm-hmm. Geithner argues that it's necessary to halt the crisis and get the economy back to growth. And here, just about a year after that, the crisis has stopped spreading. The economy is growing again, albeit slowly. And within the administration, I think they consider what they've done a great success.
Hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. We have all our lines busy right now, but keep trying, and you'll get through. eventually. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. We're talking about Timothy Geithner, the focus of a very interesting piece in the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Inside Man is the name of the piece, and Joshua Green is the author, senior editor of The Atlantic, and will be with your phone calls. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. First caller is Rick from Milwaukee. Hello, Rick.
Oh, good morning to you and your guest. I haven't had a chance yet to read his article in Atlantic, but I'm just going to kind of hoof this on my own here. I'm not as laudatory of Mr. Geithner as your guest apparently is, because I think he's too much of an insider. I tell you, this entire economic decline pretty much is limited to criminal behavior, in my opinion, located primarily in the borough of Manhattan by just a handful of American banks and AIG. I think there was massive fraud and massive insider trading, massive lobbying of bank regulatory agencies for special treatment, not for America's 12,000 commercial banks, but just for this little handful, you know, Citibank and Chase Bank. But what bothers me more than anything else, there's a law firm in Manhattan called Sullivan and Cromwell, and their partner is a guy named Bob Jiffra. And attorney Bob Jiffra is the one man who has made completely secret for the last 2 years the activities of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York City, of their discount window and the lending to these corrupt banks. I've been trying to figure out how much money has been going out here. By the way, the taxpayers are all on the hook for this. It's $1 trillion, $2 trillion, maybe as much as $3 trillion. It was an economist from the London School of Economics on the BBC who said they're committed to $7 trillion to bank these banks in case. And this is just like half a dozen banks, not the 12,000 good banks in the country. And the American taxpayers are going to be on the hook for this for the next 50 years. And there's no accountability as to who's getting what and exactly how much money we're talking here.
Okay. Joshua.
I actually don't disagree with as much of that as I thought I might. Let me take this is about a 12-part question. So let me start with the idea of Geithner as an insider. You're absolutely right. Geithner is an insider. You haven't read the piece. If you were to read the whole piece, you know, the back end of this sort of says, being an insider, I think, was useful in containing the immediate fallout. Geithner knew all the heads of these Wall Street banks. He had credibility. He was able to stop the panic in March, April of last year, and we saw things sort of stabilize. So I think in that sense, his being an insider was ultimately helpful to the country. Moving forward, I actually don't think it was helpful. And as I say in the piece, one of the problems is that this guy who's in charge of halting the crisis and bailing out these banks is also the guy who's been put in charge of writing the financial reforms. And I think that's the real problem with Geithner. Not that he's, dishonest or insider trading, but he has a view of Wall Street, of the economy, of what good rules are, of what the public interest is. It's very much in line with what Wall Street would think, too much in my opinion. On the issue of the cost of the crisis, your caller has been deeply misinformed. This is not going to cost the U.S. taxpayers $7 trillion, despite what they say on talk radio. One of the interesting things about Geithner's plan, and one of the things that's misunderstood but is at the heart of this piece, is that he did a couple of things intended to minimize the cost to taxpayers. And one of those was to try and recapitalize these banks using private money instead of using government money. If you go back and look at what happened in all these emerging market economies, generally it was taxpayers whose money was used to recapitalize these banks. And so financial crises traditionally are very, very expensive. Be as much as 5 to 10% of GDP, which at the high end would be about $1.5 trillion in the U.S. If you're talking about our last financial crisis. Because Geithner and the Obama administration were able to get private investors to come in and recapitalize these damaged banks like Citibank, like Bank of America, right now it looks like the cost to U.S. taxpayers is going to be somewhere around $100 billion, possibly even less, which is just a tiny fraction of what history says this ought to cost taxpayers. It's smaller even than the savings and loan crisis of the late 80s and the early 90s. That doesn't mean that it's a nice thing that we have to pay this money, but it means that the outcome is a lot better from a taxpayer perspective than one would ordinarily expect.
And who are these private investors, Joshua?
Just everyday people who will buy stock in Citigroup and in Citibank. I mean, what you saw at the end of last year was the government came in as part of Geithner's plan. You know, they did these stress tests on the banks, and they came up with a number and said, you know, you, Citibank, need to raise another $25 billion. Now, you can either have a stock offering and have private investors buy stock, and you can raise the money that way, or if you can't manage that, we will use taxpayer money, and we will come in, and we will give you that money, but you will then be beholden to the government and a stricter set of rules. In the event, that turned out not to be necessary. The banks were able to raise this money through stock offerings in the private market to recapitalize, to put themselves in a stronger position than they had been in a long, long time. It doesn't mean that they're healthy. They're not lending as much as the government would like them to lend, but they're also not likely to default. And so the prospect of the country kind of plummeting into another Great Depression, which was a very real prospect a year ago, is a much, much more distant one today.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rick, for the call. Frank from Madison. Hello, Frank.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Unfortunately, I haven't picked up my copy of The Atlantic, but a very interesting guest and a very interesting topic. And I would like to float this past the guest from not as a knowledgeable position, but to me, Geithner appears to be this type of ambiguous figure that has given us a type of state-sponsored capitalism. You know, that we now have a small number of very large commercial entities that are assured of state support and in a deregulated environment. So it's a type, this is a proposition, it's a type of pre-modern capitalism where corporations are essentially creatures of government. And oddly enough, this was the situation that was criticized by Adam Smith when he invoked the invisible hand. Sort of these rigged institutions will ultimately fail is what he meant when he used that phrase. So I'm not really knowledgeable, but would you care to comment? Thank you.
Yeah, a couple of reactions. That's an interesting point, and I don't think it's too far off. Dealing with Geithner first, I mean, there is a chameleon aspect about Geithner where, you know, he tends to adopt the worldview and the outlook of whatever institution he's working for. In the U.S. Treasury, it was the Treasury's outlook. In the New York Fed, which is in Wall Street, I think it was Wall Street's outlook. So I tend to think of him not as being a tool of this or that, but as sort of the good soldier whose life is the regiment. On his own terms and within the terms of his organization, I think he's hardworking and he's honest and he's honorable, but I don't think he sees things from the standpoint of Americans outside Washington or outside Wall Street. And I think that's potentially troublesome, especially now that Congress is about to turn to the task of writing new financial regulations. On the issue of the banks themselves, I think what the caller said is right, and I think it's problematic. I mean, what you saw during the crisis was that a lot of weak banks, rather than being taken over by the government facilitated mergers with larger, healthier banks. You know, you saw that in the case of Bear Stearns, for example. What we've wound up with is a situation where you have much, much larger, more powerful banks, and banks that are today operating with an implicit government guarantee. You know, Geithner has all but said, Obama has all but said, and the government has shown that they're not going to allow a big bank to fail because it would just sort of create chaos. So that is a problem, and it's one that I'm not sure that Geithner and the Obama administration and certainly the U.S. Congress are up to solving. The task before Congress is to figure out a way to write new financial reform in a way that convincingly removes this government guarantee and sort of disciplines people in the market and bankers not to operate so radically, to make such big gambles that they imperil a large bank and, by extension, the U.S. economy. The task is to sort of convince them that there is no such thing as too big to fail. I say in the piece, I don't think that they've done that, and that's problematic. I think Geithner would argue otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about reform. You write the economic recovery has eased the urgency for reform that existed a year ago. Even if the administration changed course and pushed for strenuous measures, Obama and Geithner probably lack the credibility to pull them off.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the administration's reform, financial reform plans were written mostly by Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers, two people who have, you know, fairly conservative Wall Street friendly views of how finance should look. They were unveiled last June. The Treasury Department actually went to the trouble of writing thousands of pages of actual legislative language. You didn't see the government do that on health care. You didn't see them do it on the stimulus. They left it to Congress. In the case of financial reform, they thought it was important enough, and they wanted to control the process enough that they wrote the language themselves. That was introduced in the House. What passed was very similar. It was also introduced in the Senate. What's likely to pass will also be kind of pretty similar. So in the sense... In a sense, the die was cast last fall, and you know, you can kind of fiddle on the margins, and Congress can change, you know, this or that as it moves through the House and the Senate. But for the most part, the reforms we're getting are fairly similar to the reforms that the Obama Treasury Department wrote and introduced last fall. They're not bad. They make a bad situation somewhat better, but they're not nearly as strong as I think people expected, given the magnitude of the crisis. If you asked people a year and a half ago, when we were really kind of staring into the abyss, what financial reform would look like, I think most people, even in Washington, would have said, we need something that's tantamount to the New Deal reforms that Roosevelt passed in the 1940s. And the legislation, whatever it is that's going to emerge from Congress, is going to look nothing like that. And what's sort of sad about all this is that there was a time a year ago when the public pressure was sufficient that I think it might have produced something like that. But over the year that's elapsed since, the economy has recovered. Nobody thinks we're going into a Great Depression. And so the public pressure, which is really what drives Congress to act, just isn't there for financial reform. The people writing it and passing it are people whose views tend to equate more with Wall Street than Main Street. And so I think as a result... a window has closed and a moment has been missed that might have yielded really strong reform.
Thank you, Frank, for your call. Dennis is next from Eau Claire. Hello, Dennis.
Good morning. Thursday you had a program about President Grant.
Yes.
And the term was tossed out robber barons. And how he had to fight against them to try and... unite the country and keep it together after the Civil War, and I think we have robber barons in Wall Street again, and here's another president trying to fight against them, and, you know, I wish him luck.
I think that's right, although I think I quibble a little bit with the idea that the president is trying to fight against them. I think what's happened instead is that the president has tried to co-opt them to an extent. Obama is not a populist, confrontational president when it comes to financial reform. When he tries, it doesn't sound unconvincing. It's clear he doesn't believe it. And if you look at his economic policy, it doesn't reflect it. What he's done, and this is sort of a central theme in my piece, is kind of struck a deal with Wall Street to an extent that says, and also with the U.S. taxpayers, that says, look, in the past, taxpayer money was used to recapitalize ailing banks. We don't want to do that this time. We would rather that the private market came in and recapitalized these banks, and we're going to spare the U.S. taxpayer what could have been a multi-trillion dollar bill. On that front, he has so far been largely successful, and that's good news strictly from the point of view of taxpayers' dollars going to Wall Street. The bad news is that the money is coming from private markets, and if you're trying to get private investors to invest in these ailing banks, the government has decided, Geithner has decided, and Obama has decided that they need to take a hands-off approach to this thing, that you can't, you know, crack down the way that Grant did on robber barons, the way that Roosevelt did on Wall Street, for fear of scaring off these private investors and then needing to inject government money in order to save these ailing banks. So it's a more complicated story, I think, but it's an interesting and it's an important one.
The only place where Obama seems to have railed against excesses is when it comes to salaries, bonuses, and then more bonuses for some of the executives of these firms.
Yeah, although I would argue he's been pretty hands-off on that front, too. I mean, Obama is a big believer in capitalism, you know, in American capitalism. He's not a socialist. He has taken a fairly hands-off approach to Wall Street. He's jawboned a lot about how salaries are too big, but the government has taken no actions to cut down on those salaries. Even the kind of punitive taxes that passed through the House of Representatives that would have taxed the AIG bonuses, you know, 90-95%, that originated in Congress. It didn't originate in the administration, and folks in the Treasury and folks in the White House didn't look too kindly on those things. I think what Obama would like to do, if you look at the administration's financial reform, it empowers shareholders. It doesn't create a law that would say we're going to tax bonuses, you have to limit bonuses. What it tries to do is give shareholders more of a say in executive pay, and the hope is that the private market will function such that these shareholders, newly empowered, will say, listen, these pay packages are ridiculous, and we're not going to approve them anymore, and try and sort of fix the problem that way.
Thanks, Dennis, for your call. Gavin from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I have a question, basically. It has to do with reform. Timothy Geithner, head of the New York Fed, seemed to not do a lot of regulating, more just making whatever the banks were doing, making sure that whatever they were doing was legal or above board, even if it wasn't, and negotiating extremely lucrative. I mean, the bailout, I think the American government could have made a lot more money when the banks pay back their loans, but it was negotiated favorably for the banks by Geithner. And I'm wondering, what is the future of reform if the Fed is going to be the main agent of regulation? It seems that they're really on the inside, and it's hard for them to regulate the banks. So thanks for taking my call, and I look forward to reading the article.
Okay, thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I mean, one of the troublesome things about financial reform as it's shaping up now is that it gives more power to the Fed, which was clearly asleep at the switch as the housing bubble grew. It's problematic from the sense that the main focus of the Fed are these large banks. It's hard for me to see how an agency that's that concerned with large banks can at the same time be concerned with the interests of ordinary people who do their banking at those banks. To the administration's credit, the original financial reform legislation that they introduced contained a standalone consumer protection agency for financial products. The problem is that is not going to make its way through the Senate. It's not going to be in the bill that the president signs. And to the extent that there is any kind of real consumer financial protection, it's probably going to be as a division of the Fed or the Treasury. So, it's difficult, and I think one of the negatives of having reform designed by a bunch of insiders is that you wind up with a system that looks very much like the old system, which functioned so badly, and that's worrisome.
Can you give us, I know the article goes into quite a bit of detail on deregulation, the liberal Democrats who really were in favor of that and the Republicans who were in favor of it, Jimmy Carter. We tend to think that this was something that happened because of Ronald Reagan, but there were a lot of people who were in favor of this who you wouldn't think were.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the intellectual history of financial deregulation, it isn't quite as kind of simple and cut and dried as people tend to think it is today. If you talk to people today, they generally think that what happened was that, you know, Republicans, a handful of kind of nefarious Republican think tanks, kind of conspired with Wall Street to buy off Congress and remove all these regulations. Disaster ensued, and there's certainly a large element of truth in that. But it's broader and more interesting. The idea that regulations were bad is not strictly a conservative idea, although it began to emerge in conservative circles in the 1960s, especially around a group of economists at the University of Chicago. There was also a strain of liberal thought. In fact, Wisconsin was very important,
yes,
and instrumental in this, among new left historians who thought that the financial regulations that were imposed in the progressive era and in the New Deal era were not this wonderful thing that most liberals thought they were, but in fact merely sanctified the economic order of the day, including, you know, the powerful corporations that existed then, and thought, you know, the best thing for people would be to get rid of these regulations and do something else. The new left historians, socialists, Marxists, who were really, I think, most affiliated with the University of Wisconsin, were among the people making this argument, and it resonated with Ralph Nader. And if you go back to the 1970s, when Nader was at the height of his power, after he did automobile safety and that sort of thing, he turned to a lot of government regulations. He was instrumental in helping deregulate the airline industry. He then moved on to financial regulations, and it was Jimmy Carter in 1980 who signed the first major deregulatory act, and he did so with a Democratic Congress. So Reagan, who came next and tends to be thought of as this great deregulator, and certainly from an intellectual standpoint he was, he's usually the guy that kind of gets pinned with the blame. But Democrats were complicit in this back to the 1970s, and then certainly once Reagan and Bush left and Clinton came in the 1990s, you just saw the pace of financial deregulation speed up, ultimately repealing the Glass-Steagall Act, which was kind of the central reform of the New Deal era, and opening the way for banks to get into so much trouble and create such an epic crisis.
Yeah, it's a fascinating part of the piece. Joshua Green is our guest. He's senior editor of The Atlantic and has a very thorough portrait of Timothy Geithner in the current issue of The Atlantic, Inside Man. This is the Ideas Network.
It's Larry Mueller.
If you'd like to join our conversation, our lines have been quite busy, but keep trying to get through. 800-486-8655, the email address, and we have at least one email. We'll go to that momentarily, is talk@wpr.org. Anne from Madison. Hi.
Hi. As everybody knows, globalization is really financial monoculturism. And if there's a rot in any part of the system, which has been encouraged by our mavens of Wall Street, then there's rot all over the world, as we can see in what's happening to Greece and Portugal and, Iceland, so many other countries. And I agree that maybe the banks had to be kept afloat, at least the biggest ones. But what should have happened and what happened in some other countries is they absolutely had to have those bailouts tied to strict requirements and nationalization.
Absolutely.
And
right.
You talked about the Glass-Steagall Act. That needed to be reimposed. They shouldn't have free access to ordinary people's bank accounts. And the bank should have been forced to lend again. And instead of doing that, they hoarded the money. They acted as if it were a gift. They refused to lend. They allowed foreclosures to proceed. But, until we stop allowing open bribery of all our politicians by these huge corporations, Wall Streets and others, we're not going to solve this problem. And Governor Elliot Spitzer, before his prostitution activities were exposed, when he was governor of New York and before that as attorney general, was especially interested in some of the shenanigans of Wall Street. And I wonder, what the relationship, let's say, not personal, but say unprofessional relationship was between Geithner and Spitzer.
Wow, that's a lot of ground to cover. let me start with the idea that the U.S. government didn't do what you're supposed to do in emerging market crisis. I think you're exactly right. And in the main strain of criticism against the administration and Geithner from a public policy standpoint, and this is one that's reflected, I think, most prominently in the writings of Simon Johnson, the former IMF economist, is the idea that Geithner, Summers, Obama were right to bail out the banks, because that's what you need to do in crises. We've seen these lessons in responding to the emerging market crises. But the problem came, Johnson and others would argue, when it came time to regulate and reform the banks. The emerging crisis playbook is you come in, you recapitalize these banks, you clean up the corruption, you nationalize ailing banks, and you create a tough new set of rules that kind of sends the economy and the country on a healthier course. Johnson would argue, and I think the caller would probably agree with this, that the U.S. kind of shied away from that final step. I think that's actually right, and that if you look at what happened, you didn't have those tough crackdowns. You didn't have the big banks being broken up or even nationalized. What you had was that they were sort of made healthy again and then just allowed to kind of carry on. And I think one of the reasons that the financial reforms we have are as weak as they are and sort of at the mercy of a Congress which doesn't really seem to want to crack down on these banks is because at the moment when these banks were weakest a year ago and when public outrage was kind of at its highest, we didn't step in and impose real strict reforms on those banks. And I think now that moment has been more or less lost.
And what about Spitzer and Geithner?
Oh, interesting. I actually interviewed Elliot Spitzer for this article. I think that Spitzer would agree that there was a lot of kind of self-dealing, maybe not illegal, but that, you know, the New York Fed that Geithner was president of is really a flawed institution. It's a regulatory body, but its shares are owned by the same banks that it regulates. I mean, the conflict of interest are rife. I think Spitzer would argue, and he did to me, that Geithner wasn't nearly as tough as he needed to be. But, you know, Spitzer is a guy who has been largely discredited in the public eye. He's a smart guy. He's got a great record of fighting Wall Street. But because of the prostitution and the resignation, you know, he's not someone in a position of public power who can kind of bring his will to bear against these banks. What's interesting is that his successor is New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. He's kind of picked up that mantle and is now emerged almost as kind of Spitzer's replacement as the guy, you know, most associated and most identified with really beating down on these banks, exposing the bad practices in a way that nobody in the Obama administration has come close to emulating.
Yes. Thank you so much, Ann, for your call. Here's an email that's come in from Mike. What do you think Geithner will do about the anticipated crash of the commercial loan sector?
It's a good question. I'm not sure he knows. I think the hope is that it won't be as bad as a lot of people fear that it will be, that if they can get banks healthy enough to absorb some of these losses, that it won't cast the U.S. into a second recession. But I think that's an open question. The commercial real estate market is ailing. It's clearly a cause of concern for the Obama administration, for the Treasury. And I don't think anybody knows yet quite how that's going to play out or how damaging it's going to be, especially if interest rates begin to rise. The housing market collapses when the Fed and the Treasury begin to withdraw some of their support. I think it's an important question that could go a long way toward answering whether or not Barack Obama is going to get reelected in 2012.
Let's go next to David from Fox Lake. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hello.
My question is, I've been following this recovery, and I can't figure out what's been fixed. It seems like the banks still have the toxic assets, or the Federal Reserve has them now. We still have exploding debt. We still have the current account deficit. We still have an aging population with exploding health care costs coming. It seems like all that's been done is we're allowing the Ponzi scheme to continue. Could your guest maybe tell me what's been fixed?
Well, the economy has gone from shrinking at a rate of about 6.4% to growing at a rate of about 2.2%, or I think it's up to 3 or 4%. So the recession, the technical recession, has ended and their economy has begun to grow again. That, in turn, has made the toxic assets, which you're correct, do remain on banks' books because the economy is growing again. Those assets are less toxic than they were thought to be a year or so ago. So even though Geithner and others came up with a program to buy these with taxpayer money and remove them from the bank's books, the banks have decided, hey, these things aren't so bad after all, and we could actually make money on these things. So that problem, while it hasn't gone away, has diminished from where it was a year or so ago. On the issue of the aging population, Tim Geithner can't do anything about that, but the House of Representatives passed an enormous health care bill last night that's going to cut down on the deficit. That's going to begin to get the government's fiscal account back in order. Still have a long way to go, but I think Geithner would argue that the administration has taken a lot of positive steps in the right direction. We're by no means recovered from this, but we've come a good ways in the last year or so.
Do you think the recovery can continue when the government stops spending money, though?
Good question. I'm not sure it can. One of the things that's going to be difficult. I mean, you just look ahead to next week, the week after. You know, the Federal Reserve has been buying over $1 trillion of mortgage-backed securities, which has been holding down interest rates. That program ends on March 30th. It's going to be turned over to the private market. The question of whether investors will come in and buy this stuff and keep the recovery going is an open one. The administration is hopeful that it will be, but I don't think we'll know that until we see. I think it's by no means a sure thing.
Thank you so much for your call, David. Miles from Racine. Hi.
Hi. I'm sure that your guest knows who Simon Johnson is, professor from MIT.
And yeah, we were just
Kathleen,
talking about him.
Kathleen, you've had him on your show. Mm-hmm. I heard him on public radio last week, and he said basically nothing has changed. All the root cause elements that caused the crisis last year are still in play, and we're just forestalling the next crisis. Specifically, I'd like to see what your, or hear what your guest has to say about the credit default swaps that are being used to gamble that Greece is going to fail, and in fact are helping undermine Greece. And a leading player in this is Goldman Sachs. Nothing has changed. We've just covered up the situation for a while, but the root cause elements that caused the crisis last year are still in play.
I think that's partly true, but not entirely. I mean, if you look at what was the precipitating factor of the crisis 2 years ago, it was subprime mortgages. There aren't subprime mortgages anymore. They're gone. So in a sense, some of these problems have been fixed. On the larger question of credit default swaps and financial reform, you know, here we are a year and a half after, and legislation has not been passed through the Senate. It hasn't been signed into law by Obama. So, sure, you're absolutely right. A lot of the problems are out there. You have these enormous banks that have an implicit government guarantee that allows them to raise money cheaper, that allows them, if they want to take some pretty outrageous gambles and know that they'll have taxpayer support. I think that's why it's so imperative that Congress pass some form of financial reform and do so soon. Derivatives, credit default swaps will be regulated somewhat under the legislation that's likely to emerge, but not nearly as strictly as people like Simon Johnson would want it to be. So I think Simon's point that you know, from the standpoint of right now, today, we haven't done anything to solve this crisis, and by bailing out the guilty parties, you know, we've in fact created moral hazard that will lead to the next crisis. I think there's a large element of truth in that. I think that if Congress can pass decent financial reform, it will mitigate that. But I don't think that the reform is strong enough, and I know that Simon doesn't think the reform is strong enough to get rid of it altogether.
Thanks, Miles, for your call. Brad is next. Hi, Brad.
Yes, this is Brad Bicey from Exxon, Wisconsin. I'd like to ask your guest how anybody could become a secretary treasurer if he doesn't pay their own taxes or is incapable and don't have the knowledge to pay their taxes. That's my first question.
The answer to that would be the Senate confirmed him. So
I got is about why the dollar is dropping like a rock. And being an owner in a small business, the health care and the cap and trade bill and all the spending that's going on, I'm just really scared that our economy is going to take another nosedive. Can you answer them questions for me, please?
I really can't. I mean, I don't know enough about the dollar to tell you exactly why it's dropping. As far as whether the economy is going to take another nosedive, I guess I would say that it seems much less likely today than it did a year and a half ago. But there are all sorts of outstanding questions that affect small businesses, from jobs and whether or not the economy will recover, consumer demand will recover, to things like health care reform. Now we're going to have a new law in 2 days. How's that going to affect small businesses? I think that there are positive signs. I think that the country at large is probably in a better situation today than it was a year ago. But I think it's impossible for anybody to answer, you know, how things are going to turn out.
Let's go to the last paragraph in the last couple minutes we have here of your piece. History may yet judge Obama favorably, but it's entirely conceivable that the economy could outperform everyone's expectations of a year ago, and voters will still punish him and his party. And in fact, it appears ever more likely that that's exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's hard to kind of think about from the standpoint of today, but if you go back to around, you know, September, October 2008, when the stock market was in free fall, when you know, Wall Street and Washington were in chaos, when the whole, you know, John McCain suspended his campaign because of all this, there was a very real prospect that we were all going to face a second Great Depression. And the thinking among most people in Washington was, you know, we'll do almost anything we have to do to stave off that possibility. Nobody thinks that that's going to happen today, or almost nobody does. So from that standpoint, the government's actions have been quite successful. From the standpoint of looking at what this is likely to cost U.S. taxpayers, if you go back and look at the history of financial crises to 1970s, history tells you that the cost is enormous, and that the cost in the case of this price crisis would have been somewhere in the trillions of dollars. that's not likely to happen either. So from that standpoint, I think there's a good possibility that history will judge Obama and Geithner as success for how they responded to the crisis. Not that it was perfect, but that from a historical standpoint, it was much better than you would expect. And yet, the only thing that people talk about today, not without some justification, is the high rate of unemployment, the recession, the jobs problem, but not a single caller on the show today called up and said, boy, am I relieved that I, as a taxpayer, am only going to be on the hook for $100 billion and $3 trillion.
We didn't
Thank
hear
God
that call.
For Tim Geithner. To me, that says that Obama and Geithner and the Democratic Party are going to have a tough time living this down. And as Geithner says, you know, I would rather take short-term pain at the polls than long-term pain at the cost of growth and maybe having the American economy suffer for a decade the way Japan's economy did, even if I'll never be vindicated. And Geithner doesn't think he's ever going to be vindicated.
Yeah, interesting.
He thinks what he has done is right for the country, right for Obama, even if nobody gives him credit.
Yeah.
So, interesting guy. It's all explained in the piece.
Right. It's
I'm
a great piece.
I'm not entirely convinced, but you can hear his case if you
Thanks,
want to go to the
Atlantic. Thanks, Joshua. Thank you so much. It's a great piece. It's Inside Man. It's in the current issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this program, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Until tomorrow.